offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners. I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I'm coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam. And this is a program in which we go through the shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the fifth chapter, the chapter about Sannyasa Yoga. In fact, this is the chapter where Krishna speaks about true sannyasa, not the sannyasa only in garb or only in the way one carries oneself as a lifestyle, but what it is to truly be a sannyasi. And I think that is what we are speaking about. And one of the mentions that I made in the past couple of episodes is that it's very similar to what Krishna said about Stitha Prajna, very similar to what Krishna said about a karma yogi who becomes a jnani. And what Krishna is saying here about a sannyasi is also quite similar, because that is the underlying fundamental principle. As Krishna said, all of these are only different pathways, and what one reaches, as long as one is diligent and sincere on whatever path has been chosen, the state that is reached is pretty much the same. And that's why the descriptions are similar. But whatever be the path that one takes, I think when the description of the ultimate stage is given, it gives us an opportunity to, as we have seen many times before, simulate it in our lives, because that is one of the ways by which sadhana itself can be performed. We are in the beginning of the fifth chapter, and as always, we'll begin with a short summary of the shlokas that we covered last time. We covered four shlokas, verses 7, 8, 9 and 10. The seventh shloka almost was a suggestion of the different stages that one goes through in the path of karma yoga. Of course, it is all presented as different adjectives of a jnani, but as I was just mentioning, that these are all also pointers to the sadhaka on the path. Because the verse before this, verse number 6, Krishna says that one who is a yoga yukta, somebody who has taken to the path of karma yoga, eventually becomes a jnani. And he says that term which he uses for eventually, almost like the what happens in that period when one becomes a jnani from the stage of a karma yogi, is what is mentioned in this shloka, which is shloka number 7. So Krishna says that the yoga yukta first becomes a Vishuddhatma, one who is purified in the mind. And this is more or less the first and the fundamental stage in spirituality itself. Fundamentally, or basically, goodness. A lack of greed, a lack of desire to hurt or harm another. So, simple goodness, becoming that goodness becoming one's nature, is the first state that will be reached by the karma yogi in his journey towards becoming a jnani. Then Krishna says that the karma yogi becomes a vijitatma jitendriyaha, one who has conquered the body and the senses. And we had discussed the significance of this particular statement, because it is not enough if one is good in thoughts or good in intentions. One must also have enough control over oneself to not stray into evil and to stick to the goodness or the good impulses that come from within. And that is why Vishuddhatma is the first stage, but one also has to become a Vijitatma Jitendriya. The next stage one reaches in this process is Sarvabhutatma Bhutatma, one whose self has now become the self in all beings. Right? A very beautiful phrase that we discussed about last time, Sarvabhutatma Bhutatma. The Atma which is in me, the Atma which is in you, is always one with the Atma in all beings. Right? It does not have to become one. But when the realization dawns, I now see that the self in me is the self in all. That's the meaning of this phrase, Sarvabhutatma Bhutatma. The self does not become the self in all. The self was always one with everything. But I drop the veil that was stopping me from understanding this, and I begin to see that the self in me is the same as the self in all beings, from the smallest to the grandest. So that ignorance that was blocking this goes away after I have taken to the path of karma yoga and I have been sincere on it. So when I become a karma yogi, I attain purity, I attain complete control over my mind, body and senses, and eventually I reach the state where I recognize the self in me is the same as the self in all beings. So such a person acts but does not get tainted by those actions, meaning there are no consequences. So that was the verse number 7. In the next two shlokas, 8 and 9, Krishna makes a mention of all kinds of actions. Seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving, sleeping, breathing, speaking, etc., etc., etc. So many more are mentioned in these two particular shlokas. And Krishna says, in performing all these actions, the jnani constantly remains established in the idea that none of this is being performed by him or her. He says, na eva kinchit karomi, I do not do any of this. That belief is firmly established in the person's mind. And he or she is convinced that the senses do their tasks of working with the sense objects as they are supposed to, and the individual has nothing to do with that. In the 10th verse, Krishna goes back to a karma yogi, because the jnani who is a tattvavita, knower of the truth, he or she being like this is understandable, and it is accepted that the karma that a jnani performs does not touch the person. But what about a karma yogi, right? What about a sadhaka like you and me? So Krishna says, he who performs actions as an offering to God, without attachments, even such a person will not be affected by consequences. So that is a very important statement for all of us. And he goes on to say that he lives like a lotus in a pond. The water can never wet the leaves of the lotus, right? The one of the most beautiful and popular analogies. In fact, one of the reasons why Swami would say that he is, if you have been to Prashantinilam, if you have observed the design language in most of the buildings in Prashantinilam, in Swami's Mandir, and many of the architectural elements here, you will see that there is a lot of usage of lotus. And Swami would say that this is a constant reminder that we all should live like the lotus, in the world, but not of it. Right? So Krishna says that a karma yogi also can perform action in such a manner that he or she does not get tainted by the consequences by offering whatever one does to God. And we spoke about how offering all actions to God and not being attached to the consequences almost are like two sides of the coin. I'm sorry. So this idea of doing as an offering and without attachment are pretty much the central themes of this portion of the Gita. And I could even say that they are the most important lessons of the Gita itself. Right? So that is why we had a mention of that in earlier chapters also. We are going to have a short discussion on this in today's episode also, and it will keep repeating again and again, because it's a very, very important concept of doing every action one performs as an offering to God. So those were the shlokas that we covered last time. Hopefully this time we'll have the time to complete 3 shlokas. So as always, we'll go to the shloka, we'll listen to it. I have it rendered very clearly and beautifully in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll play the shloka for you. I will then read out a very short meaning of that shloka. Then we will, as always, discuss in detail about that shloka.
Kayena manasa buddhya kevalairindriyairapi yoginah karma kurvanti sangam tyakvatma shuddhaye.
By giving up attachment, the yogis undertake work merely through the body, mind, intellect, and even the organs, for the purification of themselves. So this is shloka number 11 of the 5th chapter. As I just mentioned in the previous shloka, Krishna had said that the jnani, they perform all actions as an offering to Brahman. Of course, this is not Jnani, this is the Karma Yogi. And a Karma Yogi who performs all actions as an offering to Brahman. And they also lead lives untouched by any taint. But all through this, Krishna continues to emphasize in various ways that actions don't stop. The person continues to act, right? In the previous, he says that actions are performed as an offering without attachment. And when that is done, it is almost like when he says that the sense organs get involved with the sense objects and they perform what they are supposed to perform. It is almost like how water flows through a gorge between the hills. The gorge is not making the water flow, nor is the gorge giving water to the valley, but it is just there, and by virtue of being there, it performs the task of directing the flow. So it is being there and performing the task, but not acting. A very, very central and important theme of the Gita, and we'll come to that in this week's episode too. And when this happens, there is another process which is set off, which has been mentioned in the shloka, which we'll come to. But before we do that, I think this point needs a little bit of deliberation, the act of offering. Last week we had spoken of how when actions are done as an offering, automatically attachment to results or attachment to the opinion of others wither away, right? Because when I perform any act as an offering, it becomes a personal interaction between me and God. The next process that this act of offering does to our approach to karma is mentioned in the shloka. If I say I have to offer my actions, my efforts, my duties, I have to offer them to God or to Swami, what is the most important necessity for this process? I must acknowledge God, isn't it? I must acknowledge that there is an entity called God. And I must have faith in God. I know what I'm about to say might be a little odd for some of you listeners, but let me still try to explain it. For you and me, for devotees of Swami, there is no problem to accept this path. In fact, in a way, we are all very fortunate because we have a physical manifestation of divinity in our lives. But in general, if you look at the approach of people, this concept of God is very complicated. Even if you look at it from the point of Vedanta, my inner self is itself divine. Everything in this world, animate or inanimate, is supposed to be divine. In fact, that is the truth that a jnani eventually comes to see, and that is why he or she is called a tattvavit or a tattvadarshi, one who sees this truth that everything is divine. Sarvam kaluidam brahma. So this concept of offering to God, which undoubtedly requires a certain amount of love or devotion to God, is not possible without a dvaita bhava or a feeling of duality, isn't it? Only when I acknowledge that there is an entity called God, I can go and make offerings to Him, be it offerings of my karma, of my duty, or even an offering of a flower or whatever it is. So this belief that there is a God, He is the master, and I am the servant, or He is the Divine Mother, and I am the child, and so on. All these feelings of submission, of love, of mutual love, which will eventually be proved to be an illusion, because there is no two, there is only one. Because you are divine, the Swami that we worship is your true self, right? So eventually when the illusion goes, with that this idea that there is a God to whom I go and worship and I go and offer is going to be taken away. That illusion is going to go, right? But that illusion is required to be a karma yogi. I'm not saying that let us get illusioned. We already are in that illusion, and that becomes a tool that we as a karma yogi or a sadhaka can utilize. So this attitude of offering every action to God or all one's efforts to God is referred to by some of the commentators and of the Upanishads and of the Shrutis as Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Right? Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means, here buddhi is used in the sense of an attitude. So Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means the attitude of offering to Ishvara or God. And for this Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, there must be an acknowledgement of Ishvara or God as an entity, as I just mentioned. And since for a Karma Yogi, this Ishvara Arpana Buddhi is so important, I think it goes without saying that devotion also becomes the basis of Karma Yoga itself. And I think I must have made a mention of this also before when we were speaking about the Brahma Arpanam Shloka. So Karma Yoga and devotion or the path of Upasana are very closely tied. But I want to speak a little more about what happens when we acknowledge Ishvara in our life or when we acknowledge God in our life. And also develop and what happens with the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi coming into the picture. I think this I had also mentioned when we spoke about the concept of Swadharma, and I'm going to reiterate that here because it's a very important topic. This attitude of offering everything we do to God in a Karma Yogi is inseparable from another attitude, which is Prasada Buddhi. So Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and Prasada Buddhi are again like two sides of a coin. What is this Prasada Buddhi? The attitude of Prasada. I mean, that would be the literal translation of that phrase. The meaning of that phrase is accepting every result as a blessing from the Lord. Because even when actions are performed with the attitude of offering, it will have consequences, right? Just because I'm doing it as an offering, it is not that there will be no consequences. Let's say I go to the field and I plant some saplings and I say that, Swami, this act of planting the sapling, I'm going to offer it to you. It doesn't mean that the sapling is not going to grow, right? The consequences of that act of putting a sapling into the ground, there is going to be a sequence of events that is going to happen. Similarly, when I perform my duties, I might go to the office and do all the work I do as an offering to God with that, Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to get a salary at the end of it. So there will be consequences for the actions. But the Karma Yogi now accepts whatever comes as a prasada. So when we say that even when I'm doing it as an offering to God, there will be consequences. These consequences sometimes is success and sometimes is failure. Sometimes it is pleasant, sometimes the consequences are unpleasant. But the Karma Yogi accepts both as the Lord's prasadam. And that is the secret behind his or her equanimity and also non-attachment to the fruits, right? So when all results are equally acceptable to me, there is no attachment to one or hatred towards the other, raga and dvesha. So that prasada buddhi is as much central to Karma Yoga as Ishvara Arpana Buddhi is. The attitude of accepting whatever consequence comes as a prasadam of the Lord is as much a central or a fulcrum of Karma Yoga as the attitude of offering all my actions to God is. And we will see that these themes will be mentioned many, many times in the course of the Gita, because as I said in the introduction, it's not only the important theme of this portion of the Bhagavad Gita, but that is the essence of the Gita itself, to perform one's duties and perform one's actions as an offering to God. And it's a very powerful theme, and that is why I'll reiterate it again. As devotees of Swami, it is a blessing that we are able to visualize divinity. We do not have to convince ourselves that there is a divinity, there is God who accepts our offerings. It becomes all the more easy for us to practice this or develop this attitude of Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and Prasada Buddhi. Now, there is another consequence to this Prasada Buddhi. What I receive tomorrow is the prasadam I get for what I have done today, let's say. And I accept it with much humility and much love, and I say that I don't differentiate whether this is this prasadam or that prasadam. Whatever comes, pleasant or unpleasant, because it is prasadam, it becomes acceptable to me. So what I've done today creates consequences and that comes to me tomorrow as prasadam. If that be the case, then what I am today is a prasadam of what I did yesterday, isn't it? So my present is also accepted as prasadam. This is a very important point. Not only do I do my actions of today as an offering and accept the consequences of tomorrow as a prasadam, I look at my present and say that this is a result of something that I've done in the past. So this also is accepted as prasadam, which means who I am, my family, my background, whether I am rich or poor, what language I speak, which religion I belong to, which caste I am born in, which country I am born in, all of this becomes acceptable to me because all of this is a prasadam from Swami. And these are all some specifics which also happen to define my duty, isn't it? Because I am son to somebody, I am a daughter to somebody, I am a wife to someone, I am a father-in-law to someone, mother-in-law to someone. All of this, the present where you've been placed, is what defines duty. Right? That's how we spoke about this when we were talking about Swadharma. Which means, I accept that I have been placed in a particular situation by God and not randomly. And it is like I have been assigned a particular task. Imagine the functioning of the human body. Every organ has a specific place and a specific role. The stomach is in the place it is meant to be, right? Nobody will have a stomach in their head, nobody will have a stomach in their feet. A stomach is there in the place where it is supposed to be in the human body. Similarly, the intestines are there where they ought to be. The esophagus is there performing a specific task in a specific place. So these are all part of a whole, seamlessly performing each of their tasks. The stomach digests the food, an action is being performed there, but the stomach is not the doer. It is placed there for a purpose, and when food enters it, it performs its functions. We don't say that the stomach today digested my food, the small intestine absorbed it, the large intestine excreted it. It is all one unit. When the food passes through these different organs, the organs act the way they are supposed to and the functions are performed. There is no doership there, isn't it? Because these organs do not have what we refer to as an ego sense. They do not have a feeling of individuality. Of course, though for a sake of a story or a fable, we might say that one day the stomach thought that why should I digest, or right hand said, am I greater or the left hand greater? You know, these are all stories and chinakathas that we make of to drive certain lessons. But in reality, these organs do not have the sense of being an individual entity. But this personality that I call myself, that I call by a name, this body-mind complex, this entity with a certain form, with a certain name, I call it Prem, you call it whatever is your name, has this feeling that I am separate. And the whole idea of spirituality is to overcome this illusion of individuality, what we refer to as ego or, you know, dehabhimanam, right? The feeling that I am an individual, I belong to this body, I am this body-mind complex. The whole idea is to overcome this feeling of separateness. So in a karma yogi, this is the feeling that is being developed. When there is an arpana buddhi and prasada buddhi, there is this idea that I am put in a certain place to perform a certain task. I perform it, but I am not the doer. Just like how any of the organs in the body function. They are given a certain role, they are put in a certain place, and whatever, if food goes through it, they do a certain thing. When water goes through it, they do a certain thing, whatever they're supposed to do. But they are not the doer. And Krishna makes a reference to that in this particular shloka. He says, Kayena, by the body, Manasa, by the mind, Buddhya, by the intellect, Indriyaihi api, also by the senses, Kevalaihi, only. The word Kevalaihi applies to all the above, body, mind, buddhi, and the senses. So he says, Kayena manasa buddhya indriyaihi api kevalaihi yoginaha karma kurvanti. The yogis perform their actions, sangam tyaktva, giving up attachments. So the yogi performs actions, but performs them with these organs, without the ego, without the feeling of doership, which means the individual himself becomes like, just like how my stomach is functioning in my body, I become an entity in this entire cosmos, just performing a function, but there is no doership or individuality, right? Just like how my organs perform their tasks, my mind, intellect, my body and the senses perform their tasks, there is no ego sense to say, I am doing this, just like how, as I said, the various organs digest the food, excrete the food, or do whatever they're supposed to do. And they don't think that I have done this, I need to be rewarded. If the food that the stomach digests goes into the body, what energy the stomach needs, this inbuilt mechanism of the body will give it to the stomach. In the same way, I have been made the father or a mother or a teacher or a doctor, I will perform my tasks, and what I need, I will be given by the Lord who is ruling this whole system. And this is the combination of Ishvara Arpana Buddhi and Prasada Buddhi. Now this approach or attitude will be found in the most perfect form in a jnani, right? There is absolutely no sense of ego, there is no sense of doership, but the performance of actions will be perfect. But in the case of a karma yogi, the karma yogi is still moving towards the state of perfection. So the ego is still there. There is still desire of some form, right? So there needs to be something to look forward to. So the karma yogi will have all this attitude, but with that, there is another quality, and that Krishna mentions in the shloka. He says, Yoginaha karma kurvanti atma shuddhaye. The yogi performs actions for the purpose of self-purification. Atma shuddhi. And like we saw in the previous few shlokas here, atma doesn't mean the soul. Atma is always pavitra or pure. It doesn't need purification. But here atma refers to the sense of the smaller self. And so it is a reference to the mind. So a karma yogi accepts his or her duty as a God-given mandate, as a result of the prasada buddhi. Then performs that action righteously and sincerely and makes it an offering to God. Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, that attitude comes there. And then again accepts all fruits as prasadam. And since the aspirational nature of the mind is yet to be quelled completely, as in the case of a jnani, the yogi now gives the mind a higher aspiration than merely worldly benefits and achievements. The aspiration that the yogi gives the mind is that of chitta shuddhi. It only means there will now be a certain change in the metric of success, a change in the milestones that one looks forward to, change in what one considers as growth in this path, right? So this attitude of offering, Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, and the attitude of acceptance, Prasada Buddhi, is very important in Karma Yoga. And that is why so much emphasis is given on doing actions as an offering, and Krishna spoke extensively on the concept of yajna for this very purpose, right? He mentioned it in the third and the fourth chapter, and he's mentioning it again in the fifth chapter too. So as I said, one considers wherever one is as a mandate given from God. One performs that task to the best of one's ability, right? As long as one believes that one is the doer, one makes it as an offering to God, doing it with the best of one's ability, then receives whatever comes also as prasadam. And in the process, since the mind is still there, since the mind has its aspirations, now the mind is given a higher aspiration in saying that look for self-purification. And as I said, there are different metrics which will now be looked forward to, and some of them will be mentioned in the next shloka. So we'll go to the next shloka, shloka number 12. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Yuktah karma phalam tyaktva shanti mapnoti naishthikim ayuktah kamakarena phale satto nibadhyate.
Having abandoned the attachment for the fruit of actions, the master of yoga attains the highest peace. But the person other than the master of yoga, attached to the fruit of action, is bound by his action born of desire. So that is the 12th shloka of the 5th chapter. This is another example of a shloka where Krishna emphasizes one point and also speaks of the danger of doing the opposite or not doing what is being advised. And this is not in the sense of a threat, right? This is simple logic. As I always say, that if you go to a doctor with an upset stomach and the doctor tells you that don't eat oily food, it doesn't mean that tomorrow when you eat oily food, the doctor is going to come and punch you in the stomach, right? The doctor's advice is not a threat. Your body will punish you if you take the forbidden kind of food at that point in time, right? Similarly here, when Krishna says that if you do this, this will happen. If you do that, you will get ruined. Krishna is not cursing us. Krishna is not saying that, you know, you better listen to what I'm saying. He's just saying that this is, it's in a matter of fact manner, this is what will happen if you follow this path, and this is what will happen if you do not follow it. So here Krishna says, yuktaha karma phalam tyaktva. The yukta, or the one committed to karma yoga, as we said, whenever Krishna says yukta or yoga yukta, the reference is to a karma yogi. So he says, yuktaha karma phalam tyaktva, the karma yogi who has given up karma phalam, shanti mapnoti, will attain peace, naishtikim. The word naishtikim means final. So such a yoga yukta or karma yogi doesn't attain simple peace, but he or she attains the final peace or the supreme peace. Why? Because the karma yogi's goal is that the metric by which the progress is measured is also that peace. Krishna had said that a karma yogi will aspire for atma tripti and atma santushti. So the path, when followed sincerely, will certainly lead to nothing but supreme atma tripti or atma santushti or supreme peace, isn't it? So in the previous shloka, Krishna said that a yogi will perform all actions only with purity of mind as an aspiration. And peace is the perfect expression of that purity of mind. So these three traits of the mind, the prasada buddhi, the purity of the mind, and the peace that one experiences, are interconnected. The more I develop this prasada buddhi, or acceptance of whatever happens as a prasadam of the Lord, the more I will have happiness and satisfaction, and hence there will be more mental peace. So not only that, the more I have contentment and satisfaction, all my basal desires, like to pull the other person down, to be jealous of the other person, to get ahead of the other, to be jealous, to harm another person, all of this will automatically diminish, right? And that is how purity comes about. But what about an ayukta, a person who is not committed to such a lifestyle, who has not taken to karma yoga? Krishna says, ayuktaha, one who is not a karma yogi, kamakarena phale sakto, attached to the fruits of action, dibandhyate, is bound. Why? Because there is no way the mind's desires can ever be completely satisfied. The body's desires can be satisfied to a certain extent. At any given time, I can wear only one pair of clothes. If I've eaten my fill, the body is satisfied and it will not allow me to eat more. At least it will become a little more difficult. But the mind's desires are endless. And unless we make a conscious effort and we choose to go beyond desires, we will only get endlessly tangled in our own efforts to satisfy the mind. Just another point before we move forward. The word naishthikim has multiple meanings and different commentators have defined it differently. The translation that I first mentioned is something like constant or supreme. That's one of the meanings of the word naishthika, which means that which is firm, which does not change or that does not diminish. So in that sense, if you say shanti naishthikim, it means the peace which is supreme or the highest. The root word for naishthika, which some of the commentators used to define this particular word, in fact this is the meaning and commentary that Adi Shankara himself has given. The word can also be linked to the root word nishtha or steadfastness. If we use that meaning, shanti mapnoti naishthikim now means he attains the peace that comes from steadfastness. And this is the interpretation that Adi Shankara gives, and this also is very, very important and relevant. Not that I am anyone to certify Adi Shankara as he has given a good commentary, but I am saying that this is the point that I am able to resonate with, and I feel value in it, and that's why I thought I should share this angle of the meaning too. What is this shantim naishthikim that Adi Shankara is speaking about? The ultimate peace, or param shantim, which Krishna had already made a mention of, comes only with supreme knowledge or jnana and nothing less than that. All other forms of peace are only relative. Even the peace a karma yogi feels. Because as long as we have the mind, there will be ego, and as long as we have an ego, with it will come some form of comparison and the feeling of I don't have and I have, and peace will come and go with that feeling. But nevertheless, as I mentioned, there will be more peace than someone who is on the worldly path, right? That's why Krishna says that an ayukta is going to completely get entangled in this process of trying to satisfy one's desires. So in that sense, a karma yogi will have more peace because he is in the right direction, right? So the karma yogi will find peace, but that peace is also relative. This, Adi Shankara says, then will lead to antakarna shuddhi. This relative peace that a karma yogi experiences on the path will eventually lead to antakarna shuddhi, which he refers to as sattva shuddhi in his commentary. With this purity, inner purity or inner purification, which again is also one of the motives, right? In the previous shloka, that's what Krishna said. That becomes one of the aspirations the karma yogi gives one's own mind. So with this purity of sattva shuddhi or antakarna shuddhi will come more peace. The next stage, Adi Shankara says, is jnana prapti, the attainment of self-knowledge. This jnana prapti will then lead to sarva karma sannyasa. And sarva karma sannyasa, the way Krishna explained it, the doership is completely given up, never to return again, and that is the sannyasa that Krishna has been referring to. And this stage is referred to in the Upanishads as Atmanishta, where one is firmly anchored on the feeling that I am the Atman and nothing else. So the peace that comes with this supreme, and is referred to as Shantim Naishthikim, the peace that is got from Nishta, or the peace that is got from Atmanishta. But a karma yogi who has given up desires for the fruits of actions, Yuktaha Karma Phalam Tyaktva, Krishna says, will progressively reach the state of Shantim Apnoti Naishthikim. Because the karma yogi is still having relative peace, but through this process, as Adi Shankara beautifully explained, this will lead to Antakarna Shuddhi. Antakarna Shuddhi will lead to Jnana Prapti, and Jnana Prapti, which is another way of explaining Atmanishta, and that will lead this Shanti Naishthikim, right? So that is what Krishna is saying. truly speaking, even a worldly person will eventually reach that supreme peace, right? I think I wouldn't be wrong in saying that even someone who's steeped in worldly bliss and worldly aspirations today, sometime he or she is going to lose interest in that and is going to turn towards the spiritual path. But how will we find something if we are not looking for it at all? And even if we happen to stumble upon it, there are good chances that we will not recognize its value and we will overlook it, right? So though even a worldly person will eventually find this peace which is supreme, unless one applies one's mind to it, unless one says that this is what I want to pursue and this is what I want to achieve, the chances that one will make a steady progress towards that is very, very less, right? And that is why Krishna says that a karma yogi will reach this state, but a ayukta, one who is not given to the path of karma yoga, one who becomes a very worldly person, is going to get bound. Eventually, he or she will also break free and turn towards the spiritual path. But clearly, you can see that when one is marching towards the goal, with the goal in the mind, with the aspirations of antakarna shuddhi, with the aspirations that I should attain that jnana, that path will definitely be more straight. The steps that one takes in that path will be more forceful and more conscious, right? So that is what is being mentioned here. So that is why become a karma yogi whose goals are antakarna shuddhi, atma tripti, and eventually liberation. Even the desire for liberation will come, and that is what is important. So that is the shloka number 12 of chapter 5. We'll listen to shloka number 13 and we'll discuss about that after we listen to it.
Sarva karmani manasa sanyasyaste sukham vashi navadvare pure dehi naiva kurvanna karayan.
The embodied man of self-control, having given up all actions mentally, continues happily in the town of nine gates, without doing or causing others to do anything at all. So this is the 13th verse of the 5th chapter. As I just explained, the final or supreme shanti comes from the final stage of Atmanishta and Sarva Karma Sannyasa. But this is not physically moving away from one's duties and taking up sannyasa, not retiring to the forest. This is a change in the mental attitude. The body, the mind, the intellect continue to perform the activities that they are meant to perform. But the individual doesn't attach oneself to any of those deeds. So Krishna emphasizes that in the shloka, that the renunciation is only a mental attitude, a change in the mental paradigm. He says, sarva karmani manasa sanyasya. The jnani mentally, manasa, gives up all actions. And when he has reached the state of not being involved in any of the actions, he becomes a vashi, a completely self-controlled person. The word vasha means to have someone or something under one's grasp or grip or control. But he becomes a vashi. And here we are only talking about having control over one's own self, right? It's not about controlling the other person. So he says, sarva karmani manasa sanyasya. Such a person becomes a vashi, a completely self-controlled person. This describes an essential paradox about the self, but we'll come back to that. We will finish the rest of the description of a jnani in the shloka first, and then we'll come back to that. So a jnani mentally renounces action and he becomes a vashi, a person who is in complete self-control. Then, aste, he rests sukham, happily, navadvare pure dehi. Navadvare pura means the city with nine gates or nine entrances. And this is the reference to the human body. And what are the nine gates? The two eyes, the two nostrils, the two ears, the mouth, and the two openings for excretion and procreation. So this body is referred to as Navadvarepura, the city or the town with nine entrances or nine gates. Aste sukham Navadvare pure dehi means the jnani now dwells happily in the city with nine entrances, considering oneself as the dehi or the indweller. The human body is not considered or is not confused to be oneself. One believes and is established in the belief that one is merely a dehi, and he happily now resides in this Navadvarepura. So one of the very important change in attitude that comes about in a jnani and increasingly comes to a karma yogi is this firm conviction that the individual is an inhabitant in the body and not the body itself. In fact, if you remember, this is one of the very first points that Krishna had said right in the beginning of second chapter. He told Arjuna that you are speaking like a wise man, but if you are truly wise, you will know that an individual is only the dehi and not the deha. He is only an indweller and not the body itself. And the body only can be destroyed, the dehi is eternal, and all so on and so forth, right? So Krishna had made a mention of that right in the beginning. So very important change in attitude that comes about in a jnani and should increasingly come in you and me when we take on the path of karma yoga, when we try to, as I said, when we are doing things as an offering, when we say that the roles that I play as a father or a mother, I'm going to offer it to Swami, the roles I play as a doctor or the role I play as a functionary in my organization, all of that, when I'm offering it to Swami, the Arpana Buddhi, the Prasada Buddhi, all of this, these are all metrics that we have to look forward to. One of the metrics is a general goodness, right? Vishuddhatma is one thing what we had spoken about. There will be a general purity, the desire to harm somebody, to desire to see somebody fail, to see somebody, to have revenge, vengeful ideas towards somebody. All of this will start withering away, right? That is one of the milestones that we must look for when we are on the path of karma yoga. Similarly, are we more peaceful now? Are we more accepting about life? Do we have lesser ragas and dveshas, right? Or at least are we having that state where we don't have the deep attachment, right? That's again one of the points that Krishna had made. So these are all different metrics that one must look forward to. Are we growing in these qualities? And one more such quality that Krishna mentions here is this attitude that one is merely a dehi who is dwelling in this body and not the deha itself, which means body consciousness slowly and surely fades away, right? So the jnani is very established in this fact that he or she is not the body. This does not mean that one does not operate through the body, right? So Krishna says that the actions are performed. But again, does that mean that the jnani performs these actions through the body? Right? When you say that I am not the dehi, I've given this example of something like, let's go back to the same example that Krishna speaks about. He said the body is like a shirt, or it's like clothes that you wear, right? So when I'm wearing clothes and I'm doing actions, my clothes are doing actions along with me because I'm inside them, right? So does that mean that the jnani performs actions through the body? Krishna says, no, it is not the case. In fact, it's a very interesting and a little confusing statement, which we'll have to dwell a little more. He says, na eva kurvanna na karayanna, not acting, not even causing another to act. Neither is the jnani a doer, nor does the jnani make the body do. And this brings us back to the classical paradox about the Atma, right? This and also what I mentioned right in the beginning of the explanation for this particular shloka. Krishna said that the jnani has renounced all activity mentally, sarva karmani manasa sanyasya, and having done that, he or she becomes a vashi, self-controlled. when you give up all actions, how can you still be in control? Doesn't these two things appear like contrary to each other? They don't seem to gel together, right? I've given up all actions, then how will I still be in control? How will I be a washi? Imagine a boss. We can only think of an active boss when we speak of a boss who is in control of his team or control of the project, isn't it? A boss who is proactive, who is always having an ear to the ground, jumping into situations and setting right things or driving the project energetically and meeting the dead ends. And you know, you only imagine somebody who is very, very active being in control of a project or a team or a situation, isn't it? How to then put together the idea of someone who's not at all attached to work, doesn't want anything, doesn't crave for anything, and someone who is a washi, who's in control? When I'm in the state where I'm convinced that I'm not the body, how can I then be in perfect control of it? Now, if we really ask this question, what makes me go out of control? What makes a person go out of control? Say in the same example of the boss, we'll go back to that. Let's say the boss likes one employee a little more than the others, or there are a few employees the boss can't stand. He has a specific and a directed hatred towards a few employees or a few members in the team. Or the boss, let's say, has some strong fancies and one employee figures that out and now starts doing favors for the boss. Or the boss has some personal agendas. Or let's say the boss is given to bad temper or he's a very impatient person. These are all ways by which a boss will eventually lose control over the team or over the project. Right? In the same manner, when I'm a Navadvare Pure Dehi, the indweller of the city with 9 gates, what makes me lose control over this Deha? Not any external enemy. It is my own Raga and Dvesha which makes me weak, isn't it? Because of that, I am not able to stop the senses from going their way. I am not able to control my passions. I can't control my temper. I can be easily manipulated because I have strong likes and dislikes. But when I completely sublimate this Raga and Dvesha, I can certainly function with a very clear head. I can do what is supposed to be done, and I can be in perfect control of the situation. So with purity, all distractions are removed, and one is in perfect control over oneself. Even though one doesn't identify with the body, mind, and the senses. I think this is a little more subtle and probably requires individual manana for us to grasp this, right? I certainly, even though I'm explaining it to you, I certainly will need to think about it for me to understand this completely, right? In this case, it is the more you are detached from the body, the senses, the mind, the intellect, and all of this, the more you will have control over it. The more you believe that you are the body, you are the mind, you are the senses, the more you don't have control over it. Right? It's a very beautiful and very subtle point that is being made here. Then comes the other paradox, which I was saying. The paradox in the line, na eva kurvanna na karayanna. Not acting, not even causing to act. Not even making the other one act. Na eva kurvanna na karyanna. We say that without the Atma we cannot act. And the illusion is in identifying with the body and the mind and the ego and thinking that this personality, this body-mind complex is the one who acts. But then we also say that the Atma is not the doer, nor does it do, nor does it make another person act. How do we put these two together and how do we understand this? This is a clear paradox, right? And in fact, I had explained this a few times before, at least one time before, and I think I'll repeat it a little quickly here. When it is said that the self does not act or make another act, the reference is to any form of doing or karma which is driven by a desire, a need, or a feeling of incompleteness. Whenever we do something, whenever we act, we take up an activity, it is because we need to do something, we have to achieve something, we feel that we have to get somewhere, we have to become something, right? So always a karma is born out of some form of desire, and that is what is referred to as karma, right? Otherwise it becomes like a bodily action, like when you're in sleep, you turn over when you're sleeping, right? That probably does not qualify as karma that we are talking about. And when we talk about karma yoga, when we talk about akarma, that is not the karma that we're talking about, which happens very, very involuntarily. We're talking about karma only in the sense that which we do with a certain purpose, right? And that purpose invariably is a sense of incompleteness. It's a sense of, I need to get something done, I need to become something, right? So we primarily perform all actions, all karma, only in that manner. But a jnani is in a state where he or she has completely removed themselves from the scheme of things. There is no desire, there is no need to, as I said, he or she feels complete as they are in that very moment. So when karmas are performed, it is performed only as being part of a larger plan. I'm saying that with no other way of, no better way of explaining that, right? So in that sense, the individual is in a state which is referred to as nothing is done, but everything is accomplished, right? It's one of the very beautiful ideas in Zen philosophy or Taoism, right? One does not do anything, but everything that needs to be done is done. It's a statement which had come, I think, in the second or third chapter too, right? So when we say that he neither does nor does he make another do, it is in this sense that there is no desire to propel a karma. There is no desire to inspire an action. But when we say that the Atma is the doer, the body or the mind is not the doer, the Atma is the doer, there we are referring to what we call sentience, right? I have a light in front of me. I have an AC which is running. I have a microphone which is amplifying my voice and sending it across to you. All of this will not be possible without the current that is running through this, right? So everything is made possible because of the current running through, but the current is actually not doing anything. The current is not illuminating the space. The current is not making my voice reach you. But without the current, I cannot do that, right? So when we refer to as, what we refer to as the, without God, nothing is done. Without God, no activity happens. Even a blade of grass does not move. We are referring to sentience, right? That is the basis on which everything happens. But when we say, as in this shloka where Krishna says, na eva kurvanna na karyanna, it neither does nor does it make anyone do, nor does it compel the other to act. It means that there is no desire to cause that kind of karma. It is just there as a, in the scheme of things, right? Just like, as I said in the beginning, it is like a gorge which is there between two mountains, which is directing the flow of the river. Is it directing the flow of the river? Yes, it is. But is it doing the act of making the river go in a certain direction? No, it is not. It is just there. It is being there in the larger scheme of things. There is no individuality, there is no ego sense, there is no feeling that I am the doer, right? So these are things which I think we use the same words that we use to describe our otherworldly activities, and I think that's one of the reasons why probably it's confusing, it's paradoxical. And as I said, these need self-reflection, and how many ever times we read it, it requires self-reflection and it requires a certain amount of practice. Trying to be in that, you know, we might not yet be there where we are completely in that state, but we certainly can simulate this at least few moments in the day and few activities that we perform. And I think that is the homework that each one of us have to do, you and me, right? It's not about just merely reading it or explaining it to you. So with that commitment to Swami, that Swami, even as we go through this Bhagavad Gita, we will try as much as we can to develop that Ishwara Arpana Buddhi. We will try and consciously develop that prasada buddhi, and we will allow these attitudes to purify our mind, and we will allow our ego sense, our body consciousness, to slowly and surely fade away. I think with that commitment to Swami and also a prayer to Swami, I will conclude this week's episode, and I most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. Do join me again next week for the continuation of this Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care. Jai Sai Ram.